Hello, this is Gidon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 9th of Shavat. Today we're going to actually see two quick tshuvot, one by Rav Uziel on hiring Jewish workers, and one by the Tzitzit Eliezer on whether we're allowed to remove a Sefer Torah to read it only one time. I think I chose these because they were topics that jumped out at me, so even though the tshuvot were a little shorter than they needed to be able to fill up all of our time together, I chose them anyway. That always gets to the question of how I choose these things, and mostly I'm trying to find things that are somewhat interesting from Mishivim, who are people that we'd like to get to know better, and that fill the time. But then I cut down tshuvot tremendously, sort of almost doing them an injustice by cutting away at what they're in, but I try for an interesting range, and I hope that you enjoy it. Okay, so Rav Uziel, from the fourth volume of Shu'ot Mishpatei Uziel in the Choshen Mishpat section, Simon Mem Dalet was asked about Jewish labor. It's from the 9th of Shvat of Tafrei Shtadi Hei of 1935. This is actually a tshuva written to a Rav Moshe Findling, who I personally had not known well, but I just looked him up, and there is a book in HebrewBooks.org called Techukat HaAvodah, The Laws of Labor, Labor Law in Among Jews, and it's from about 10 years after this tshuva. Rav Uziel says he's responding to him. He says, I saw your very interesting tshuva, your very interesting response on the issue of hiring Jewish labor, and now I'm answering because you asked me to express my opinion about it as well. So in the book on HebrewBooks.org of Techukat HaAvodah, he says, with the addition of the comments or the reactions of important Jewish rabbis, I assume that Rav Uziel was one of them. So it seems like this man is writing a book, is together a book and asking for the impressions of great Torah scholars of the things that he's writing. So Uziel says, I like what you wrote a lot. I will notice that you said that the reason to hire Jews rather than non-Jews is it's an aspect of tzedakah, an aspect of charity. And that is not incorrect, he says. If you look in Yeridaya, Resh Mem Tet, paragraph Vav, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rambam's eight levels of tzedakah, eight levels of charity, and the highest level of charity, this sort of a well-known comment, is when you give a person a job or you give them money to be able to start a business and things like that. So here too, hiring a Jewish person is a high form of charity because it gives them the ability, especially if the competition is a non-Jew, you're helping the Jew find a way to support themselves, and that is a mitzvah of charity, a great mitzvah of charity. Rav Uziel says, I think there's another mitzvah as well, because we have a Gemara that says, Rav Uziel points us to a Sifra in Bahar. If there was a little bit of a pause, I apologize. I might not have been paying attention to whether I had the machine on pause or not, but I think I did. Anyways, there's a Sifra in Bahar that says, how do you know that when you sell items, you should sell only to your fellow Jews if you can? When you sell to your fellow Jew, how do you know when you buy? There's also in the verse, it says, Okano miyad amitecha. So from there, the Sifra understands. Now, Rav Uziel assumes that this is a mitzvah d'rabban. He says, mitzvah chachamim zoh, hi binyanah v'chol avodah. He understands this sifra not to be setting up a Torah obligation, saying that's what the pasuk means. The pasuk says, when you sell to your friend or buy from your friend, you can't do anah, you can't overcharge them in fraudulent ways, and that's all discussion of its own. The sifra says, and how do you know that when you buy and when you sell, you should be doing it with Jews? And it quotes this pasuk. Rav Uziel assumes that's a mitzvah d'rabbanan, and then he also assumes that it applies not only to buying and selling, but all forms of work, all forms of hiring, all forms of labor, all forms of negotiations, whatever it is, we should, he thinks that Chazal were telling us, at a rabbinic level, we should be preferring to conduct our business with Jews, not with over non-Jews, to help support them and help them out. That, he says, also obligates the laborer to prefer working for Jews and to prefer giving his time to Jews. Now, I think we've seen together another comment, another response of Uziel's, where he thinks about labor as being this good that owners need as well, and as if owners don't always have an easy time finding labor. So he speaks of it here as if I'm going to be a laborer, I should want to give my time and effort to Jewish employers rather than to non-Jewish employers. That's the way Uziel is understanding it. It's an interesting perspective, meaning, let's suppose I'm not going to be the guy who starts the company, but I'm a valued employee and I contribute well so that I can do it to a Jewish company, a Jewish employer, or a non-Jewish employer. He says, I should, according to this chazal, prefer a Jewish employer to a non-Jewish one because I'm giving them the benefit of my efforts. Now, there's a lot to talk about here that he didn't get into that I think he would have agreed with in terms of this is assuming they are relatively equal to each other, although they're going to be, he's going to talk about some sacrifices he thinks Jews need to make in order to hire Jewish employees. We'll get to that in a second, but fundamentally, let's say I'm a great computer mind and I program well, and I could just do that program for a Jewish company or a non-Jewish company. Rav Uziel seems to think that all other things being equal, and that's the part that he didn't necessarily put in, all the things being equal, I should prefer the Jewish company. Now we're going to come to where it gets a little more complicated, but then before he gets there, he says also, the Torah says, the Shulchan Aruch says, also how do you know that when you if you sell an Eved Ivri, it's not Shulchan Aruch. This is also a Sifrei in Devarim that he's quoting now. How do you know that when he is sold, it says, Kitik Ne'evet Ivri, how do you know when he's sold, an Eved Ivri is being sold, a Jew is being sold into slavery, he should only be sold to you? So a similar kind of thing from the fact that it says, when he's sold to you, that's the assumption that should be sold to you. So you have it by an Eved Ivri, by a Hebrew slave as well, you have it, that's when he sells himself because he needs money and he's completely destitute. It would also be true if a Beit Din is selling somebody into this kind of really indentured servitude more than slavery. Also there, the Beit Din sells to a Jew, not to a non-Jew. So from all of that, Rav Uziel says, you see that there's a preference for Jewish labor and for keeping labor within and among Jews to the extent that we can. So that's what he says. So that, in other words, it's not just if I'm hiring a Jew and I prefer to hire a Jew, it's not only that it's a kind of a stuck up by hiring the Jew, it's that it's really a mitzvah d'rabbanan, that is a rabbinic obligation to the extent that I can, keep Jewish labor and the Jewish economy intra-Jewish to the extent that we can in terms of hiring and not. Now, if we can't, if there's the market saturated, we don't find opportunities, then you go to the non-Jewish world. But preferably, it would be something that Jews would hire each other and give business to each other. I can't, I was just saying it. I was just reading an article by Ta-Nehisi Coates about President Obama. Long, long article. I didn't read the whole thing and I got tired of it. And there's a lot to be said about it. But he quotes an incident where I think a friend of the president's, I think Marty Nisbet, who's apparently a very good friend of President Obama's, talks about the fact that when he went to buy a car with his wife, she said, we're waiting for the African-American salesman. And he says, but he's busy with somebody else. Let's just, you know, go with a Caucasian, a white salesman. He says, nope, we're waiting for the African-American to give their business and their commission to the African-American. And spoke about the fact there was this powerful sense in that particular community of African-Americans of supporting each other and helping each other out. So that's something like what Rav Uziel is understanding the tradition, the halakhic tradition, to say about us as well, that when we can give business to Jews, we should be doing so. Then he talks about, and this is where it gets even more complicated and more difficult and an obligation of a different version that he sort of recognizes some of the complications, but as a human challenge and an economic challenge becomes an interesting one because it says, how much do you pay for a Jew? So he says that question is not a purely economic question, right? Economists would say you have to pay the market rate, meaning no less, but also no more, because if you pay more, then you're going to hurt your business and you're going to have a harder time competing with others for business, and your business is not going to succeed as well. So he says that's not the way we should be figuring it. He doesn't say all that. He just says we don't figure it that way. The obligation is that you have to pay a living wage. Now, in America, you'll talk about, in lots of other countries, you'll talk about a living wage, just the amount of money people need to get by. But for Jews, it's always slightly different because Jews have lots of other obligations. So, for example, even if you take something silly, if I said, you know, I'm going to pay a Jew the exact same as a non-Jew, well, the Jew has to buy a lulav, the Jew has to buy Pesach items and, you know, and matzah, and the Jew has to buy at least occasionally kosher meat. And so even if I say, well, that's on them, sometimes they have to buy kosher meat, and the Jewish salary, therefore, has to reflect that. Ruzil saying, you have to figure that. But then he goes a step further. He says, you have to pay b'midat dargat ha'chayim shemakom avodato. You have to give a living wage for the place, meaning the median, the reasonable way to live for the place where that person's living. So if rent is high where you live, then you have to give him extra for rent, meaning in the economic world, I just say, well, I only have to pay him the wage that people in that area are willing to accept, and if that means they have to commute 2 hours, they have to commute 2 hours. It was still saying, no, that's not the way it works in Jewish labor. When we hire fellow Jews, we have to pay them a living wage for their for their living circle, for their living circumstance, for the place in which they're living. Let me tell you a story. I once actually applied for a job as a rabbi in a shul. I, for a long time, wanted to be a rabbi in a shul, wanted to get back into the rabbinate. It has not yet worked out. We'll always wait and see what happens. And there are always issues about where I can move to or not move to because there are other people involved in these decisions. But there was a shul, and it seemed like it was in a place that I could have moved to and joined the shul. And I went and I had an interview, and I thought the interview went pretty well. Later, somebody else told me that he didn't think the interview went as well as I thought it went, so that could be. But all I'll tell you is that soon after that, sometime after the interview, the president of the shul calls me, and he says, and he's not a member of the search committee, he says, I want to talk to you, and he claims that my answers are not going to affect the search committee at all, and I have no idea whether this is true or not, but he says to me, how much do you think you'd want in salary? And so I really should have said, it's not the time to answer that question. We can talk about salary after. It's just, you know, it's premature. But instead, what I said is, I think I'd want to make, I said, you know, I can negotiate this, and I'm not being absolutist about it, but I think I'd want to make, you know, the average of what people in that community make who are in my life stage. You know what? I'd want to have the average salary to live an average lifestyle in that community. Now, I didn't get the job. I didn't get a call back to come to spend Shabbos at the shul. So one person told me, who had reason to know, and it had to do with my performance, which may be true. I don't want to take that away. But somebody else who also had reason to know told me that it was because I was going to cost too much money because they eventually ended up taking somebody who would have cost them significantly less. So that's an issue that comes up, and it's coming up here because Rav Uziel is going to say that you have to pay your Jewish laborers an amount that will support them in the neighborhood in which they're living. And he says it's not said anywhere explicitly, but it's something that I think you can infer from other halakha contexts. Because when it says about an Eved Ivri, the halakha is the Torah says, Ki tov lo imach, it's good for the Eved Ivri with you. When you have an indentured servant, it's got to be good with you. And Chazal understood that to mean, there's a Gemara in Kiddushin, that he has to eat and drink what you eat and drink, to teach the owner, the master, the employer of the indentured servant, whatever the right word is for that relationship, that he has to keep the indentured servant at his level. So that's an important insight into what people always see the words, that always people see the words Eved Ivri, Jewish slave, and they think that Judaism had a concept of slavery, but it's very different than the slavery that people talk about in today, because if you had a Jew who had been sold to you for whatever period of time, let's say for 6 years, during those 6 years, if you're having lamb for dinner, that indentured servant got lamb, right? You had to keep them and let them live at the style of your house. It was like they were sort of guests in the house who happened to do a lot of work with you, but they had to be treated like members of the household. So from there, Rav Uziel is inferring that's true for an Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri has to be brought, the indentured servant has to be brought to the level of the owner. Well, an employee, though, you don't have to bring him up to your level, right? If you drive whatever car, you don't have to, you know, a new car, you don't have to give him a new car to, for his things. He can drive a used car. But you do have to pay him sufficient that he can live at the standard of living of the society, of the community in which both are living. Raziel says, I can also demonstrate it to you from the fact that the Sifra says, that if, when your brother is sold to you for indentured servitude, that you have to treat him like a brother, meaning the relationship, it is factually, there's an ownership element there, but experientially from the side of that owner, it's supposed to be a brotherly relationship. Yes, I bought your labor. Yes, you're working for me, but you're my brother who haven't been working for me. So among the experiences of brotherhood, if brothers really care about each other, it's to worry about the livelihood of the employee. So if you're going to do it for an indentured servant, all the more so you're going to do it just for an employee, that you can't pay them an amount where it's true. They can, theoretically, if they didn't have to send their kids to a Jewish day school, and they didn't have to buy Yontif clothing, they didn't have to buy Yontif kosher food, and then after this and that, they can make it, because we see the non-Jews are making it, but that's not the way it's supposed to go. You're supposed to worry about them in that way. So too, the Torah says about ribit v'cheyachicha imach, that he'll live with you, and the Gemara in Bava Kamma says, you have to return interest that you took, because you have to worry that his life be comfortable, he be able to get by in life. And that's true as well, Ruziel claims, for the wages that we pay to workers. And now he takes it a step further, because in many areas of halakha, we talk about the fact that you don't have to add, you don't have to go beyond a certain point to try to fulfill the halakha. And sometimes you're not allowed to go beyond a certain point. So we're often allowed to add more than a third to wages. He says, that doesn't mean to wages over and above what a non-Jew would get in that situation. He says, it's a third over and above what the Jew should be getting in that situation. So too, there's a halacha that you shouldn't spend more than a fifth of your money. You shouldn't waste it. But he says, that's about tzedakah issues. But this isn't a tzedakah issue, right? The Rav Moshe Findling, who wrote him this question and was talking to him about it, and he thought it was a tzedakah issue. But he's just in the middle of saying that it's not just a tzedakah issue, and the not just a tzedakah issue, he thinks there's room to pay more than a fifth. So that means that he's suggesting that if a Jewish salary that would keep a Jew going would be more than 20% more than what a non-Jew would get, the Jew would still be rabbinically obligated, the Jewish employer would still be rabbinically obligated to hire the Jew and not the non-Jew. And then he makes that even broader. He says he doesn't think that whole idea that not spending more than a fifth of your money applies. He thinks there's lots of places that doesn't apply. So for example, he says, anytime there's a mitzvah with tzedakah, the real mitzvah is day machsoro, is as much as the Jew is lacking. Sorry, that's another topic. I don't want to get into it. He doesn't get into it. He says, any mitzvah that the obligation rests upon the person, this whole idea of a shear, of an amount, doesn't apply. It's really the best of his ability. If he's able to, he has to get it done. So he says, well, the Ramah says, we don't spend more than a fifth on these things. The Ramah's example is an etrog. So he says, yeah. But that's because the mitzvah of etrog only applies to you if you are able to get an etrog. And if you're not able to get an etrog, then you don't have to do it. And the halacha is that if you'd have to spend more than a fifth of your money to get the etrog, that qualifies halachically as not able to do it. But when you have a mitzvah that's obligatory on a person, so that's a whole different kind of a thing. An example he gives is pinyon bechor. If you have to redeem your firstborn son, you can't just say, well, I don't have the money because it's more than a fifth of my money. Rav Uziel seems to think that that's not true because you have a continuing obligation to, meaning with etrog, if you can't get one, then you don't have the obligation. But with pinyon bechor, you have the son already and you have to be posed with the son. He says that there, the one-fifth amount doesn't count. And the same thing, he thinks that if an ani came to you, if a poor person came to you and he's just in front of you and it's just your job, for whatever reason, it became your obligation to support this poor person. He doesn't think it's true that once you went over a fifth, you wouldn't do it. He thinks you would do whatever you could to try to support that poor person. And that comes up here in the employment as well. If you have a business and you need to employ people, and the halacha is you're supposed to employ Jews, and those Jews need a salary of a different level than non-Jews, and that's what you have to pay them, and you have to do that. He even suggests that since you're supposed to hire Jews, if you then hire non-Jews, you're sort of violating a prohibition, and when it comes to violating prohibition, we generally say that money should not be a factor, that even if it's going to cost huge amounts of money, even more than a fifth, that you're not allowed to violate prohibitions, you just have to spend whatever you can to try to avoid violating a prohibition. So here too, he says he thinks that would come into play in this situation. And that's where the tshuva basically ends. He closes by saying, we learn that there's a mitzvah to hire. There's a mitzvah both on the Jewish owner and the Jewish employee to try to find each other and to work together and to fulfill all these issues and to pay the right salary that would keep them living at a reasonable standard for the community in which they live. Lots of economic questions there. You'd have to sort of enter this project with a lot of faith that by hiring Jews and paying them the reasonable wages, which is for Jews, that I don't know that Hashem would bless your business and you would therefore have enough money to continue doing so. But economists certainly wouldn't appreciate this. There's a reminder that Rav Uziel was A, not an economist, but B, and more importantly, didn't think that economics could be the only thing that we bring to the table. And therefore, he thought we should be hiring Jews and we should be paying them a living wage for Jews, not just a living wage, whatever that would be. And that is our first response of the day for the 9th of Shvat. Next one, another topic that comes up commonly and regularly, which I think why I was struck by it, this is from Tzitzil Yezer, Yud Zayin Yud Bet, the 17th volume of Tzitzil Yezer. It's a tshuva from the 9th of Shvat of Tafshin Mem Vav of 1986. And there was a community that was asking him a question, and the community had a shul, and then in a nearby building to the shul, there was sort of a Beit Am, it's like a community center. And in that community center, which has lots of other things going on it all throughout the week, on Shabbos, they would have a teen minyan. And it's not a lot discussed why they want to do it. It seems like it's a teen minyan. Maybe it goes faster. Maybe it's more comfortable for people. But they had this teen minyan, but they didn't have a Sefer Torah in the teen minyan. They didn't even have a shul in the community center or a place for an Aron Kodesh. What they would do is they would take a Sefer Torah from the shul, the nearby shul, and then And they would go, like in the morning, Shabbos morning, they would go after Shacharis, and they would pick up the Sefer Torah, and then when they would end davening, they would bring it back. So the problem with that is, and the rabbi writing this letter to the Tzitzit Eliezer says, it goes against Yerushalmi Yoma, that says, we're supposed to follow the Torah and not have the Torah follow us, meaning there's a certain lack of respect in us making the Torah come wherever we want it to come. We should be going to where the Torah is. And so too in Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Haim, Kuf Lamed Hey, Yud Aleph, it says that you're not supposed to be moving a Sefer Torah just for one time, to use it one time. Now, the man writes that when he came to his job in this new community, it had been going on, this teen minion, this, you know, youth minion, had been going on for a long time. And there had been rabbis there before, and nobody had ever objected to it, nobody ever complained about it. He didn't want to make a fuss about it. And he thought, I won't say anything. Mutav Shiyu Shogit is an important principle in Halacha. We're sure the people will listen to us on many, many occasions. We don't speak up. That's a reminder, by the way, to most of us that just because great rabbis see something and don't say anything doesn't mean that it must be okay. I remember for years, people would tell me things like, you know, we never had an Eruv, and everybody strolled their strollers, and there were great rabbis in the community, they never said anything. Or, you know, great rabbis used to always go to the beach with their families, and everybody was in whatever they were in, and there was mixed swimming, and nobody said anything. So it's always a question asked when you find people who don't say anything, who you might say something. So here is why you might want to think twice about whether that means they agree to it. There is a general principle of halacha, applies in certain cases, but not all cases, but many, many cases, that if you're sure that people won't listen to you, better you not say anything to them, because then they can count as shogegin, as not being aware that they're doing something wrong. Whereas if you tell them and they continue doing it, then they're no longer shogegin, now they're doing it deliberately. Which, by the way, as halacha says that, we have to get back to the answer, but as I think about that, it reminds me that halacha obviously seems to assume that if Rabbi X says to somebody, you know, you're doing the wrong thing here and here and here, and they continue doing it, they no longer kick out the shogun because they've heard from an authoritative source that they're not supposed to be doing it. Even if they say, no, you're wrong, I don't agree with you. So I'm not sure. It could be that we mean that they believe him and they do it anyway. Anyway, coming back to our situation, this rabbi writing to the Tzitzit Eliezer says, so I was trying to say nothing about it, but I have a regular shir in halacha in my shul, and we got to Siman Kuf Lamed Hey, where the Shulchan Aruch says you can't move the Sefer Torah. And somebody said to me, what about the youth minion? So I have to give an answer, and I don't know what the answer should be. So he's writing to Tzitzit Eliezer, tell him about what the answer is. Tzitzit Eliezer says, I, first of all, am surprised that those who came before you allowed this to occur when it's against the Yerushalmi and against the Shulchan Aruch, and the Mishnah Berurah agrees to it, so I don't understand why everybody ignored it. So I think the answer to that question is what the rabbi written, because they knew that this is a thorny situation, and people aren't going to listen to them, and therefore they didn't want to make a fuss about it, because they don't do about it. So he says, if they would leave the Sefer Torah, where the minion was going to be for a day or two, you could say, there's the Mishnah Berurah there, says, in Sifkat Memtet, something that gives the sense that if it's there for a day or two, rather than just for the moments of the reading that it's needed for, just for the service that it's needed for, that might be enough. Today it's common to say that you want to be able to read from it three times. So this is saying, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah, it seems like the Torah is going to be in a place for a day or two. That might be enough to avoid this problem, even though it's something that comes up every single Shabbos and every weekend. So you shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't have to not have a place there for it, but if that's what it is, there'd be room to say that. And the Shulchan Aruch, by the way, it was talking about a case of people who were in prison and were bringing a Sefer Torah to them so that they can hear Torah being read even while they're in prison, whereas here, they could, since it's the answer, they could come daven in the shul. Right? So he doesn't, since the answer does not in this Jew, as far as I can tell, as far as I've seen, I mean, as far as I understand it, he doesn't give any credence to the idea that the teens will say, we prefer it being just us, or we prefer the speed, or we prefer this. There's lots of reasons why they don't want to dive in the big shul. But he's saying, whatever those reasons may be, they can dive in the big shul. So to make a Torah go to them, that's a self-centeredness. He doesn't use the word self-centeredness, but that's what the source of the Yerushalmi had said. The Yerushalmi said, you're supposed to follow the Torah, not the Torah follow you. So when I tell the Torah, it has to come to me because I need it to come to me. I'm mistreating the Torah. I'm treating the Torah with a certain lack of respect is the point underlying this whole halacha. So it says here too. The minyan saying, we don't want to be in that big Knesset. We want to be here. And therefore, the Torah has to come to us. So unless they have some other reason, he says. So basically, people who are in prison have a reason. So if they come up with some reason, but he doesn't immediately know of a reason, then you can understand it. But at the very least, you'd have to have the Torah. He says, be there for a day or two, meaning instead of coming Shabbos morning to get it, he says, he's basically saying they should come Friday afternoon and get it, return it Sunday afternoon. And that way, it wouldn't be coming just for them. That would be its new place, and 2 days a week, its place would be in that community center, wherever they would put it, and the rest of the week they would be in the shul. And then he mentions the custom to read it three times. He doesn't seem to be adamant that that has to be done, although it is true that if they brought it Friday afternoon and left it till, let's say, Monday morning, you'd get three times every week if you'd have a minyanim there, but they only have youth minyanim. So in any case, that would be, but at the very least, they can't return it immediately, they have to, because then it'll be clear that they're bringing it for them, and that's a zilzul of the Sefer Torah. It's a mistreatment of the Sefer Torah, because what's supposed to happen is that we go to it, not that it come to us. So he says, well, you'll tell me, and I think they did tell him, that there's no place in the community center to leave it for a day. He says, that's not my problem. He doesn't say those words, but yeah, it doesn't create room to find a heter. So, and then he throws in parentheses, he says, and by the way, the whole idea of davening in a Beit Am, which is a community center, which is a place that in during the week they do all sorts of other things to it, that's not so preferable either, and that's not what Hashem wants of us. That's the way we understand the nature of Beit Knesset, especially since there is a Beit Knesset, there is a shul nearby. And he had quotes, which he often does, this, or maybe this doesn't surprise you, it does me, perhaps just because I don't work this way. Sitters not only had encyclopedic memory of what he had learned, right? It's not only there's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, he seems to have had encyclopedic memory of what he had written, meaning he's written hundreds, if not thousands, of tshuvot, and he seems to remember each of them and be able to look them up because he references them often in his book of responsa. So he says here, you're supposed to be davening in the shul. It's better to daven in the shul. This is a problem that comes up today a lot. People daven. I am part of a minyan that davens in a non-shul. And that's a whole hard question as to when we allow that and how we allow that. So he's saying it's not preferable to daven in a non-shul. That's true, let's say, of house minyanim also. Friday night and Shabbos afternoon, house minyanim. Tzitzis would have the same, I think you'd have the same problem with that. You're supposed to be davening, ideally, in a shul. There are always complicating factors in life, and other things come up, but I'm not posculating. I'm just saying he's bothered by it. And he says it's especially true because it's not like an occasional thing. It's not like we decided once to have a minyan in this Vietnam for whatever reason because we were going to have a bar mitzvah and there was no room in the shul. It's every week, and it's every week for years and years and years. And then we force the Sefer Torah to come to us. This minyan forced the Sefer Torah to come to them because they don't have a place for the Sefer Torah. So he says, if they're going to listen to you, and it's not always clear they will, here are the things that I can imagine allowing. One easy thing that I can imagine allowing, he says, is move the youth minion to the shul. Not to the big shul. He doesn't mean fold them in. It would be great if they would fold into the bigger minion, but that's not what he means. He means finds a room in the shul building and let the minion be there because, halachically, we have precedent that says that to move a Sefer Torah within a shul building does not count as moving it for all these purposes, and it doesn't have all these elements to it. So he gives examples of those who have said that if you have somebody who lives, let's say, on a roof of a courtyard or an attic of a courtyard, and there's a shul there, those are connected enough that if those are connected enough that you can move a Sefer Torah from one place to the other if you have to. So you see that within the shul building, and maybe even slightly more, there's another example he quotes that if you only have a shul, Ramat says that if there's only between the shul and the base medrash, 4 amot of distance, so that would be small enough that you could probably do something. You could move the Torah from one to the other there as well. So if they're in the nearby environment, if they're in the same building for sure, then there's room to say that they're not really moving it, and therefore you could say that it'd be okay. So that would be the best thing, basically. Best thing would be then for them to move this minyan from the community center into a place that's close enough to the shul. It's either in the shul building or it's close enough to the shul, really close to the shul, that it can be considered part of the same compound as it were. And he says, and by the way, if you did that, they should still know that it's certain that there's a kula here, that where there are people who would be stringent about this, and it's already a kula for them. And the reason I think you would stress that is that sometimes people sort of act the halacha, you go out of your way to help them out, and you bend back over backwards, and they treat it as like, oh, it's our right. So he wants them to understand that we're trying to help ourselves. There are those who disagree. So the Zohar thought that you couldn't move a Sefer Torah from one shul to another, and Rav Yaakov Emden paskin that way. They didn't even move it for now. That's not necessarily because that may be from one shul to another shul building, where they're completely separate from each other, whereas here it would be from within the building. But he's saying there are people who are machmir on this issue. And the Vilna Gaon was quoted in Ma'aseh Rav as saying you don't take it even from one room to the other. So that would clearly be against what this idea would be, and therefore they should understand that this is a kula. Another possibility, he says, is if they're not willing to do this, then the only room that he can find to allow it, if they're really going to oppose it and really not going to do anything else, is he says if they sent a minion each time to get the Sefer Torah and a minion to bring it back. Then he found a book called Ha'ikare Ha'dalet Taf by a name, an Italian rabbi named Rabbi Daniel Tierney, who was in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and he wrote a Sefer, and he said that there's a situation where people want to bring a Sefer Torah, I think, to their sukkah, and he didn't like that for the same kinds of reasons. So he said if everybody who's in the sukkah would go up and get the Sefer Torah, then it's not it coming to them, they're moving to it. So too, if they were to bring a minion of people, of men, who would come get the Sefer Torah, and then a minion of men would bring it back, then there's room to do it. So, Tzitz Eliezer asked about moving a Sefer Torah. So the fundamental problem is not that you don't like to move a Sefer Torah for no good reason, it's that we're not supposed to be bringing a Sefer Torah to do our bidding. We're supposed to recognize that we're supposed to do the Sefer Torah's bidding. So, that means that you can't. So if you brought it for a day or two, then you could just be that it's a new place for whatever reason. Sefer Torah have their place, whatever the reason, it's changed place. A day or two would be fine. If you can't leave it there for a day or two, the better option would be then for them to come and move to into the shul building and have their minyan there, and then moving it within the building is a much less complicated halachic issue. If they're also not willing to do that, then the only room he finds is if you did send a minyan of people to bring of men to bring the Sefer Torah each time to bring it, and then to bring it back, that would be good enough as well. So, two responses a day for the ninth of Shvat. Question of Jewish labor and paying proper prices, first of all, preferring to hire Jews, paying proper prices for them to give them a standard living that they need, and then, to Eliezer, on moving a Sefer Torah when you can and cannot. Have a great day.